Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network in British Studies. I'm Tyler Yank, a co-host of the channel, and today I have the immense pleasure to be speaking to Dr. Miranda Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies at the University of London, where she also co-convenes the popular What's Happening in Black British History series. At the same time, Dr. Kaufman is a freelance historian and public speaker, working with a wide variety of media outlets and publications, including the Sunday Times, BBC, and the National Trust, and acting as a historical consultant on numerous museum, exhibition, and media projects. One of the most notable, I think, being the 2016 BBC Two award-winning series, Black and British, A Forgotten History. Today, she is with me to discuss her new book, Black Tudors, The Untold Story, which was published in 2017 by One World. Miranda, thank you very much for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Miranda, I wonder if you could begin by saying a little bit about yourself and some of the projects you've been involved in over the past few years.
So I've been doing history for a long time, it feels. I did history A-level, I did history at university, undergraduate level, master's, and my doctorate all at Christchurch, Oxford. My doctorate was on Africans in Britain, 1500 to 1640. And I always wanted that to become a book. But I sort of spent some time in journalism and other sort of freelance historian stuff before I found my book deal eventually. And my book, Black Tudors, as you say, came out last year. So I've always been doing some other things on the side. I've done exhibitions with the National Trust, and I've always been really interested in public history. So, yeah, working with museums or public bodies, or, you know, just sort of giving talks, sort of communicating history beyond academia to a wider public.
Great. So when it comes to, I guess, the subject of Black Tudors, this is something that you've been working on for a long time. What kind of piqued your interest in this subject?
Well, I'd always been quite obsessed with the Tudors, but I was sort of trying to find something specific to research. And I was in a lecture talking about early modern trade, and they suddenly mentioned that the Tudors had started trading to Africa in the middle of the 16th century. And that's really surprised me, because I'd kind of assumed that that trade only started in maybe the 18th century. And so I wanted to find out more. And when I went to the library and started reading, I suddenly found these references to that actually of being Africans in Tudor England. And I was really surprised then. But, you know, there didn't seem to be a lot written about it in the books I was looking at. So I decided I needed to start digging into the archives and find more information.
Yeah, I mean, I equally, reading this book, was so surprised by some of the materials that you found in such an early period, reference to people of African descent living in England. What are some of the assumptions or paradigms, I guess, that your book sort of serves to shift or undermine?
Well, in Britain, there's something called the Windrush myth, you know, which actually kind of got played out. I don't know if you saw the London Olympics opening ceremony in 2012, but they had this whole episode in the drama where they had this sort of opening ceremony celebrating Britain. And they had this bit where the Windrush, the Empire Windrush, a ship arrives in Britain in 1948 with Caribbean migrants on board. And they sort of the way, which definitely happened, you know, 70 years ago. But people often assume that that was the first arrival, really, of significant arrival of Black people in Britain at all. So my work is part of a larger project to show that there's been a Black presence in Britain since at least Roman times, that sort of goes all the way through, really. And so, like you said, people don't expect there to be Africans in Tudor Britain, but there were.
Indeed. What was the geographical scope of your book, would you say?
Sorry, going back to paradigms, one of them is about the presence, and the other big paradigm is the assumption that all Africans in kind of Western history until, you know, the 20th century, more or less, were enslaved. And, you know, one of the big arguments in my book is that actually these Africans in Tudor England were free, and we find them being paid wages, being allowed to testify in court, being baptized and recognized by the Church of England. And crucially, there is no kind of set of laws that legalize slavery in England. there's a whole concept of free soil. If you set foot on English soil, you become free. So I think that's another really important misconception that I set out to challenge.
Yeah. What was that the case? Were people who set foot in English territory in the Tudor period free?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I found at least one example of an African person actually testifying that that's what happened to them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So then I guess getting into the book a little bit. So your book traces the lived experiences of 10 individual subjects, ranging from a trumpeter to a silk weaver to a prince. What was your process in selecting these 10 people?
Well, they're kind of self-selected because although I found references to hundreds of Africans in Tudor England, a lot of them, you know, are recorded in what I sort of call one-liners. So you'd have one line in a parish record saying, John, a blackamoor, was buried today. And you can't find it, you know, it was almost impossible to find any more biographical information about that individual. So the 10 individuals in the book are sort of the 10 that I had the most information about to really sort of try and piece together a life, or at least a sort of key moment or set of incidents in that person's life, the ones that really had a story to tell.
Who did you find the most interesting to research and write about?
Oh, it's tough. It's tough. you know, I did each at a time, so I was sort of excited by them each as I was sort of going along. But I think delving into the world of kind of swimming and diving expertise in the Jack Francis the Salvage Diver chapter was really interesting. Learning about kind of early methods of diving was quite sort of amazing, and thinking about the skills he had. And it's always fun when they get involved in a court case, because then you get everybody fighting, and that's always quite fun. I loved sailing around the world with Diego on Francis Drake's voyages, and those and learning about the Panama Maroons who sort of formed a military alliance with Drake in chapter 3. And you know, with that you've got this evidence of the voyage accounts, which are always a bit more sort of dramatic than, you know, the old dry mm-hmm. parish register, and also, you know, there's crazy stories there. And there's also we also have all the Spanish officials' accounts of complaining after Drake has raided their port or their ship, sort of saying, oh no, you know, this has happened. And those were quite fun to read as well. I really enjoyed Prince Dederijekawa, learning about his kingdom in modern day Liberia on the River Sestos. And, you know, that the fascinating kind of concept of these early, you know, we think of if an English person takes an African person onto their ship, you think they're going to enslave them. But actually, in his case, and in a few other cases I compare him with, you have young African men being brought to London, taught English, and then taken back to Africa to work as translators and trade factors, which was, I think, you know, a really fascinating phenomenon. But yeah, there's lots of good stories. Obviously, Edward Swarthy, chapter 4, who is the first known African to whip a white Englishman, which he does on the 3rd of December 1596 in rural Gloucestershire. But I mean, that's a sort of unbelievable story, and was even more exciting because absolutely nobody knew anything about it until I found it in the National Archives, entirely serendipitously, because you know, I went there and I was sort of sitting down with the search engine and putting in different search terms. And I tried putting in the word Negro, and only two results came up in the whole of the National Archives catalogue. And one of them was irrelevant. It was a document to do with something that happened abroad. But the other one was the testimony of Edward Swarthy, alias Negro, in this court case. But it was just incredible—a stroke of luck that I found that, because that his particular testimony had, at some point in the mist of time, become separated from the other documents related to the court case, because the rest of the court case is filed under the names of the two men who are fighting the court case. So it's called Buck versus Winter, and it's only because that document was separated that it was catalogued using his name. And if that hadn't have happened, I would never have found him.
Oh my goodness. I love those kind of stories, though. They make your little historian heart beat faster. So I also actually really liked in the first chapter with even John Blank, he casually petitioned Henry VIII for a pay raise as a trumpeter. And I was just thinking, it must be so exciting to come across some of these documents.
Yeah, it was good to find that one. I actually found a reference to it in a book, and but I was away from London, but I had a friend who was at the National Archives that day, so I was like, can you call this up and photograph it for me, please? Yeah. And he sent it over, and then I like transcribed it within the hour, and he was also very excited. This is a colleague of mine called Michael Ohijiru, who has been so inspired by the story of John Blank that he set up this whole thing called the John Blank Project, www.johnblank.com, which he's commissioned over 30 artists to draw pictures of what they imagine John Blank would have looked like.
Oh my gosh.
And poetry and music. He has these wonderful evening symposias where all the artists talk about their work and the poets read their poetry and the musicians, do their music. And it's always opened by a current man of African origin who is a current trumpeter in the royal household, turns up in his full regalia and plays the trumpet, plays like a little piece on the trumpet. So yeah, we're looking for a space to sort of hold an exhibition about all of that.
Somewhere. Oh man, that would be exceptional.
Yeah, it's so great. It's so great. Check out the website.
I will. Has it been difficult finding, I guess, women and children within the records?
It's not hard to find children because a lot of the records are baptism records, and so they're actually kind of second generation baptisms of children who tend to have one African parent and one English parent, or in some cases Dutch or Portuguese. So there are plenty of children, but then it's hard to trace what happens to them next. And again, I mean, there are plenty of women. Again, you kind of get people in the later centuries, people talk about there being more men present in Britain than women, partly because of the nature of enslavement, and that you would rather enslave men because they can work, they're more physically able to do the backbreaking work involved. But in my period, I found relatively equal numbers of men and women in the records. But the problem is then finding women that we are able to piece together their lives with more information, because the women tend to be these one-liners I was talking about.
Yeah. And coming back, so what would you say, based on sort of each of these chapters, what's the geographical scope of your book? It seems to take sort of a world history scope to some degree.
Well, it starts in Britain. Britain didn't exist at this time. The British Isles. Because it was called Black Tudors, I actually left out most of the research I'd done on Africans in Scotland as part of my doctorate. So there were Africans in Scotland, but they only get a mention in passing in the John Blank chapter, because they're mostly at the court of James IV of Scotland. So that was a kind of parallel to John Blank and the African presence at the English court. But I did find a few other stories. And actually, there's a woman who's now researching a man that I came across briefly, but she's found more records about him. And he starts out as a sort of trumpeter in Aberdeen, but then he turns up in the church courts accused of adultery, and then he turns up again as a highwayman and gets executed. So that's going to be quite the story when she gets that out. So there were Africans in Scotland. But because of the nature of their lives, when we find Africans in the British Isles, we then have to ask the question of, well, how did they get here? What were they doing? And in order to answer those questions, you end up going all the way around the world.
And then I guess in terms of the writing style, you use these really compelling sort of narrative snippets at the beginning of each chapter, and you employ a more playful narrative chronological style throughout. So why did you choose this style for these stories?
I think people are, basically interested in people. So whereas my doctorate, which was a sort of, an academic piece of writing, told this history thematically – you know, with chapters on how Africans came to Britain, what their working lives were like, what their religious lives were like, you know, what their legal status was, this sort of thing. For the book, I just thought it, because I was trying to reach as wide an audience as possible, I thought it was more engaging to tell the story through people's lives and, you know, the things we know about these 10 people's lives actually illuminate some of those bigger themes in when you tell those stories, those themes come out. So that's, I think, why I did it that way.
Yeah. And then you just mentioned religion. So I was actually curious about this. Where do you see religion sort of fitting into the stories of some of your subjects?
This is a tricky one because from a modern perspective, the idea of renaming someone with a Christian name in a baptism ceremony can seem like a sort of effacement of African identity and sort of... But I think we need to think about it from the Tudor perspective. And that, you know, it was a deeply religious society. People were killing each other about whether they were Protestants or Catholic. You know, the Reformation was ongoing. It wasn't just, you know, a hobby on Sundays. It was fundamental to the way people lived their lives. And so I think accepting Africans as fellow Christians and accepting them into the parish community was actually a sort of symbol of social acceptance. Mm. And a sort of understanding of at least being equal in the eyes of God. But it's, you know, it's interesting because in this period, you know, I'm finding a lot of these baptisms were of adults, but the church liturgy was not equipped for this. There was no specific conversion ceremony outlined in the Book of Common Prayer until much later. And so they kind of fudged together the infant baptism and the adult confirmation processes and sort of fit them into one thing. But I mean, it's interesting as well in that it shows the difference between Protestant and Catholic approaches to baptism. So the Protestants have this big emphasis on education and engaging with the text of the Bible. So before these Africans, and actually in one case that I found incidentally, an Indian boy from the Coromandel coast of India, these foreigners are expected to learn enough that they can recite the Lord's Prayer and the Articles of Faith and answer questions about their faith in English. Wow. Before they're allowed to be baptized. In one case, a London merchant called Paul Baining leaves money in his will for the education of his African servant in the Christian faith. He leaves this money to the local church minister to provide that education.
Do you see a shift, I guess, as it gets closer to the 18th century, the late 17th, early 18th century, with the onset of the transatlantic slave trade? Do you see like a shift in the records or the way that sort of free and unfree occupations and peoples are being framed in any of these records?
Well, my doctoral search only went up to 1640, and actually I was sort of covering a period where there's an absence of British slave trading. We know that John Hawkins did his four voyages in the 1560s, but if you look at the statistics, which are helpfully on a website called slavevoyages.org, which was a huge project to map all the transatlantic slave voyages of all the countries throughout the whole period of the slave trade. If you look at the British records on that, there's a huge surge after 1640, but there's very little before that. So the period I researched was before the real onset of the British involvement in the slave trade. However, there's a scholar called Kathy Chater who has written a book about the African presence in Britain in the long 18th century. Mm. And she sort of starts in the sort of 1660s. And there are some similarities and some differences. Africans continue to be baptized. They continue to sort of work in England in a variety of occupations. But I think more research needs to be done, especially on that transition sort of between 1640 and 1660. And So I'm hoping that we will be able to sort of fund some PhDs to continue what I'm doing. I did sort of to sort of consolidate it and cover the whole of the 17th century as well, and then in their research be able to start having done that, to start to answer those questions of how did things shift, when did they shift, did they shift as much as we think they did. I think attitudes clearly did change, especially once the most common way in which you would encounter an African was as an enslaved person on a slave ship or on a slave plantation. You're obviously going to have associations with that are negative. Whereas in my period, there's a whole range of ways you can encounter Africans. Sometimes they are ambassadors, sometimes they are merchants, sometimes they are maroons with military capabilities. Sometimes they are artisans or skilled people like the salvage divers, the silk weavers of this world, the needle makers. So you obviously have a whole other different set of associations when you meet people in those roles.
Yeah. I would say my actually two favorites in the book were actually two of the women. So Anne Cobby, who worked in a brothel in the 1620s, and that of Catalina, who you frame as an independent single woman. Could you share a little bit about why each of these cases are so significant?
I think in my answer earlier, I was mostly talking about men, wasn't I? And so there were a few women that I was able to find out more about than the one-liners. And part of the reason you tend to emphasize Anne Cobby is that she was actually an anomaly in that she was the only example of a definite provable example of an African prostitute that I found in early modern London. And I think scholars in the past have assumed that African women were likely to be working as prostitutes, in the context of discussion about Shakespeare's Dark Lady of the sonnets. So I do try and stress in the chapter on Anne Cobby that she was the only definite black prostitute that I came across. And if there were more African prostitutes in London at this time, we would know about it because the records of the Bridewell Court, which are constantly dealing with prostitutes, have been gone through, and there aren't that any references to African prostitutes in those records. So, but she is interesting, but she's described as having very soft skin, which is so attractive that men will pay, well above the going rate in order to sleep with her, much more than, the other women in the brothel that she's working in. Although, I mean, she appears in the court records as working in a particular brothel in Westminster, belonging to John and Jane Banks. I gave a talk last week and one of the women in the audience, his surname was Banks as well, was spelt with the ES. And she was quite concerned to know whether these people could have been her ancestors or not, but wasn't able to satisfy her curiosity on the spot. I said that spelling was a bit unreliable in the 16th century.
Fluid. Yeah.
Right. So what about Anne? I mean, I think, The archival record of Anne Cobby is fairly fragmentary in that we only have this one kind of deposition accusing John and Jane Banks of being brothel keepers, which was of course illegal, mentioning her and mentioning her soft skin, and we also have the information about the other women she was working alongside, but from that I've tried to kind of retrace her steps and create a picture of what it would have been like to be a prostitute in early Jacobean London. So that's what I did with that chapter. And similarly, in a way, all we know about Catalina of Almondsbury for sure is what her goods were, or at least which goods the assessors thought it was worth writing down that belonged to her on her death in 1625. And the most valuable thing she owned was a cow.
Yeah,
which is more significant. People think, oh, right, yeah, cow, that's funny. They tend to laugh when they say this. But actually, you know, people don't realise how significant owning a cow was in rural society at this time. You know, a cow was a very valuable possession. You could graze the cow on the common land. You could get milk, you could get butter, you could get cheese. If you had surplus, you could perhaps sell it. I found it quite difficult to find context for this from the period, but I think some aspects of rural life remain unchanged. And I found in the 18th century records of parishes actually giving poor women, particularly, a cow as a form of poor relief, because once they had the cow, then they would be able to support themselves a bit better, which was interesting. It was a sort of detective work. I had this list of her possessions, and I was trying to glean as much as I could about her lived experience from this information. For example, she has a candlestick and a tablecloth, which are clearly kind of not necessities in life. Although candlesticks are probably more important for electricity than they are now. But yeah, it was a pewter candlestick. It wasn't sort of the most basic material, which suggests she had a sort of slightly below, above average standard of living for that class. And in fact, I mean, the very fact that there was an inventory made of her goods shows that she knew that she owned some property. Which is partly significant because people assume that the African people themselves were the property in this context. And if you were enslaved, you didn't tend to have property legally. But also, the total worth of her goods in the inventory, it was above, £9 or something. £9, £6 and ninepence, or something like that. Anyway, it was above the kind of base rate. You would only get your goods put down in inventory if it was above, the total value was above £5 or something.
Sure, yes.
So she's sort of not quite on the breadline. And yeah, but her kind of lack of having sort of most basic furniture suggests that she must have shared lodgings with somebody else.
And then I guess my last kind of question is about marriage. So of these 10 subjects, were any of them married, and who were they married to? Or do you have a sense of that?
John Blank is married to a mystery woman in 1512, and Henry VIII buys him a nice outfit for the occasion.
Ooh.
Sort of velvet cap and cloak or whatever. So we don't know who she was, but on the balance of probability, she must have been a Londoner, because there just weren't that many African women in England in 1512. And then let's go through them. Not Edward. Reasonable Blackman, chapter 5, was married as well and had at least 3 children.
Yes, again, yes.
2 of whom die of the plague.
Oh, yeah.
Within the same week, in October 1592. But we know absolutely nothing about his wife. But again, on the balance of probability, I assume she must have been an Englishwoman. We don't know. By that point, it's the 1570s, so there would be more chance of him possibly marrying an African woman, but it seems unlikely to me. With Anne Cobby, there's an interesting moment. Again, can't really prove it, but I did find a marriage record for a woman called Anne Cobby in the right parish at the right sort of time. So shortly after the brothel has been raided and shut down, she gets married. And it wasn't that unusual for prostitutes to get married. There is definitely other examples of it happening. But I couldn't prove for sure. But then Anne Cobby didn't seem to be the most common name at the time. So it's possible she got married. Mm-hmm. But I did find marriage records for other people. And there is an incidence of most of the marriage records I found were between Africans and English people. And although most of them were African men marrying English women, there were examples of the reverse. So in Bristol, there's a woman called Joan Maria who marries a man called Thomas Smith, who's described as a billis maker, which means he made bills, which was sort of kind of weapon. The only records I found of African people marrying other African people were in St Dunstan's and All Saints Stepney in the early 17th century. There were sort of three marriages quite close together in time. And at least one of the African men there is described as a sailor. So Stepney, obviously being on the River Thames and quite a kind of maritime area.
That is so interesting. I wish we could listen to all of the anecdotes from the sources that you've used. I'd like to wrap up our conversation by asking sort of the traditional final question with New Books Network. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm quite excited about my current project. So I'm the lead historian on a project called Colonial Countryside, and it's based out of the University of Leicester, but we're working with 10 National Trust properties to explore their history of colonial connections. So not just to Caribbean slavery, but also to, which is obviously my sort of area of relative expertise, and but also to the East India Company and that aspect of British colonial history. And we're working with creative writers, but also with primary school children who are also going to be mini creative writers. And they visit their houses, they learn these histories, and then they're going to go off and write personal essays and poetry and creative writing. And it's eventually in year three going to be published. So that'll be 2020, published and promoted, and hopefully inspire the rest of the National Trust properties to investigate this element of their histories. And sort of a slightly related project, I've just signed a new book deal for my next book. It's going to be called Heiresses, the Caribbean Marriage Trade. So I'm looking specifically at women who inherited slave-produced wealth from the Caribbean and then married into British society. Some sort of notable examples, probably that Horatio Nelson married a girl from Nevis. Sir Hans Sloane of Sloane Square fame, who actually was a huge collector, and whose collections formed the basis of the British Library, the British Museum, the Natural History Museum, and the Chelsea Physic Garden, married a Jamaican heiress. The novelist Tobias Smollett married a Jamaican heiress. You know, and quite a few, you know, earls and dukes show up in the registers as well. I'm also going to be looking for, if I can try and find some examples of dual heritage women who at the time were called mulattoes. And interestingly, there seem to be, so far, I found more mulatto heiresses in the literature of the time than in the reality. Famous examples being Mrs. Rochester in Jane Eyre. There's also an heiress from St. Kitts in Vanity Fair. And another in Jane Austen's unfinished novel Sanditon. And there's also quite a lot of kind of lesser examples in less well-known novels from the period. So I'm having a lot of fun investigating that.
Miranda, those sound like great projects. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. So thank you again.
You're welcome.